My father appeared. I jumped from my seat and ran into his arms, sobbing and laughing. He pulled me to the stone steps leading to the outside. Señora Leona closed the classroom door behind us. Papi wiped the tears from my face with his handkerchief. He held me against his side and rubbed my head. "It's all right," he whispered. "Don't cry. It's all right." We sat on the steps, and I told him how mean Señora Leona had been, how awful the place we lived in was, how scared I was when I closed the baby's eyes. It felt good to tell Papi these things. We sat there until the lunch bell rang. Kids filed out of classrooms and looked at us. Some of them pointed and laughed. "Wait here," he said. He went into the classroom, and I heard him talking to Señora Leona. He laughed. She laughed. He backed out of the room carrying my books. He waved to her and thanked her. He took my hand and led me down the steps. She came out of the room as we were going out the door. Papi didn't see her, but I did. She gave me a dirty look and pretended to spit in my direction. Then she turned her back and walked away, her heels clicking on the hard, polished floor. Letters from New York. Escapé del trueno y di con el relámpago. I ran from thunder and hit lightning. I will not forgive you again. I've closed my heart. It is useless to cry. It is useless to call. I will never forgive you. The jukebox blared the lover's troubles. His voice cracked a little when he sang that his heart was closed. But no matter how final he meant it to sound, eventually he would forgive his woman, and they would go on living, loving, and fighting, just like Mommy and Papi. Once he found us living afloat the Black Lagoon, Papi wooed Mommy back, and we moved to one of Santurce's busiest avenues. The building had once been a private house, but the new owner had divided it in half to make a two-room apartment in the back and a bar facing the street. He had placed a jukebox in one corner of the front room and a tall formica counter along the side wall. A pool table, lit from above by a single yellow bulb, seemed to float over the sticky tile floor between the music and the liquor. "You are never to go into the bar," Mommy told us on our first day, "and don't ever talk to anyone going in or out of there. When you go to school, follow the route we've walked and don't stop anywhere in between." My new school was a few blocks down the congested avenue, through a gate into a cracked cement yard ringed with hurricane fencing. I walked to and from school alone, unable to befriend the sassy girls with budding figures or the boys who leaned against fences and lampposts to hiss and leer. "If a boy says something to you," Mommy warned, "just ignore him. He'll find someone else to bother." But boys paid no attention to my scrawny legs and flat torso. If they took notice of me at all, it was to comment on how fast I walked. "What are you running away from?" they'd call out as I whizzed past them, books tight against my chest, eyes focused on the spot in front of my feet. At home, we grouped into a tight knot, two adults and seven children inside two rooms. The wall dividing our side of the house from the bar was made from shiny sheets of fake wood paneling, but the rest of the walls were rough, splintery boards painted pale green. The front room was just big enough for a table and two chairs, and Hector and Raymond's fold-out cot. The girls' beds were along the walls of the back room. Mommy and Papi's bed was against the paneled wall, a curtain separating it from our side of the room. Our nights were punctuated by the deafening percussion of drunken ballads, clashing billiards, clinking glasses, and nightly brawls. "I can't sleep, Mommy," one of us would complain, and Mommy would find cotton to stuff our ears. "Try this," she said, knowing it wouldn't help. Nothing helped. Over the din, we heard men laughing, yelling obscenities. "You are not to repeat those bad words, or you'll get a mouthful of hot peppers," she'd scold. Sometimes a woman's voice broke through, and then the men shouted louder. Glass shattered violently, and the songs on the jukebox went from boleros about betrayal to guarachas and merengues about the good life. "Those are not good women. Decent women don't go into such places," Mammy explained, a scared look on her face. We slept with windows and doors bolted. At night, the bar's customers, in search of a bathroom, found their way to the rear of the building, where they peed against our walls or retched under the tree. Mornings, on our way to school, we hopped over curdled puddles of vomit and fetid urine stains on the dirt. "At least," Mammy said, "we have electricity and running water. We didn't have that in Macung." Raymond's foot was still raw and blistered from his accident almost a year earlier. Sometimes, with no warning, he'd develop a high fever and pus formed in angry bubbles along the scars left by many operations. Mammy would rush him to a clinic where the wound was once again scraped and dressed in bandages. After many such visits, the doctors finally told her that it might be best if Raymond's foot were amputated. "Are they crazy?" Mammy complained to Papi that night. "They can't figure out how to cure him, so they just give up." "They know what they're doing, Monin." "Whose side are you on anyway?" She scooped Raymond onto her lap with effort because he was already 5 years old, tall and gangly. "Just because everyone has given up on him doesn't mean I'm going to." She cradled him and rocked him back and forth until even I could feel her warmth, her yielding softness. "Don't worry," she muttered into his ear. "I won't let them cut off your foot." Raymond reached up with his skinny arms and grabbed her by the neck tightly, as if that alone would keep the thing from happening. "I'll find a specialist, someone who knows what he's doing, not like those charlatans in white coats that call themselves doctors." Her voice was soft but angry, as if it were the doctor's fault Raymond's foot got snared in a bicycle chain. I folded inside myself, wishing I could go back to the dusty road in front of our house and grab Raymond off the bike before Jenny rode away with him. "There's a letter from Tata," Mammy sang, waving a thick envelope. She ripped it open. "With a note for you, Neggy." My grandmother in New York didn't write very often, but when she did, I sent her one of my best school compositions, or a drawing, or a joke copied from the newspaper. She rarely responded directly, but sent hugs and kisses in Mammy's letters. The lined airmail paper was so thin, I took it into the shade because the midday sun shone right through it. She had folded it tightly, as if she didn't want anyone else to open it. "Dear Neggy," she wrote in a broad, graceful script, "thank you for the story you wrote for school. It was very good, but I had trouble reading it because your penmanship is so poor. It's always hard to read what you write. Next time, take more care forming your letters for this old lady. Love and kisses, Tata." My eyes burned, and a trembling pain started in my gut and moved out like water into an overfilled glass. "Oh, good," Mammy exclaimed as she read her letter, a happy expression on her face. She turned the page with an eager smile, her right hand over her heart. I crumpled Tata's letter and threw it into the yard. Mammy looked up. "What's the matter?" "Nothing." I collapsed into her lap. "What's wrong? What did the letter say?" She was as upset as I was, her eyes darting from my sobbing face to the balled-up letter in the yard. "Hector," she called to my brother, who was practicing marble shots into a hole in the ground. "Bring me that piece of paper." She read it, took in a breath, and put the paper under her thigh so the breeze wouldn't blow it away. She held me for a few minutes, then raised my face up and wiped my cheeks with the hem of her dress. "From now on, when you write to Tata," she said with a smile, "print." That night, as Felipe Rodriguez sang that his love had left him with nothing to keep him company but a bottle of rum, I heard Mammy and Papi murmuring in their bed. The noise coming from the bar made it impossible to hear everything they said, but after a while, Papi was angry and rolled out of bed. I heard him open the door to the outside and go out into the night. He didn't come back for days. Because of all the running around she had to do with Raymond, Mammy couldn't work a steady job anymore. Still, his medications and doctor visits meant we needed money, so Mammy talked our landlord into paying her for cooking a daily caldero of rice and beans and a stack of fried chicken pieces or pork chops, which he then sold at the bar. Sometimes she left the house not in her work clothes, but dressed a little better than what she wore around the house. She didn't tell us where she was going on those days, and it was years before I learned that she went to clean other people's houses. One day, I came back from school to find a rope stretched across the front room and men's white shirts, clean and crisp, hanging in a row. "Don't touch them, they're not ours." "Whose are they?" "They belong to the laundry down the street." She spritzed some water from a bottle onto the cuff of a shirt and pressed the iron against it, making the steam rise up to her face. "How come you're doing their ironing?" "They were very nice and let me bring the work home instead of do it there." She finished the shirt and put it on a wire hanger alongside the others. Of all the things in the world Mammy had to do, this was her least favorite. She liked cooking, sewing, mopping, even dusting, but she always complained about how much she hated ironing. "Can I try to iron?" Her eyebrows formed a question mark over her round eyes. Her mouth toyed with a smile. This was probably the first time I'd ever volunteered to learn anything useful. She turned off the iron and looked for one of Papi's old shirts in her clean laundry hamper. "We wouldn't want you burning a customer's shirt," she chuckled. She stretched it on the board. Quietly, she showed me how to set the temperature for linen or cotton, how to wet my finger on my tongue and listen for the sizzle when I touch the flat bottom of the iron, and how to keep the electric cord from touching the hot metal, which could cause a fire. She turned over the bottle of cold water and sprinkled the inside of my wrist. "This is how little moisture you need to get the steam to rise." She curved my fingers around the handle, pressing the iron against the fabric, while with the other hand she pulled the cloth taut. "Always iron the inside button and whole plackets first, then the inside and outside collar, then the cuffs." We danced around the ironing board, with Mammy guiding my hand, pressing down on the iron and standing away for a minute to see me do as she taught. The steam rose from the shirt and filled my head with the clean, fresh scent of sun-dried cotton, and bubbles of perspiration flushed along my hairline and dripped down my neck. But I pressed on, absorbed by the tiny squares in the weave, the straight, even stitches that held the seams in place, the way the armhole curved into the shoulder. "You're doing a good job," Mammy murmured, a puzzled expression on her face. "This is fun," I said, meaning it. "Fun?" she laughed. "Then from now on, you do all the ironing around the house." She said it with a smile, which meant she was teasing. And she never asked me to do it. But after that, whenever I wanted to feel close to Mommy, I stacked wrinkled clothes into a basket and, one by one, ironed them straight, savoring the afternoon when she taught me to do the one thing she most hated. In early December, our landlord fenced in a corner of the yard and led a squealing pig into the enclosure. "Christmas dinner," he said with a grin. With Papi's help, he dug an oval pit near the back fence, lined it with rocks that we children gathered, stuck two Y-shaped sticks at the edges of the hole, and laid a sturdy rod between them. "This should do," he smiled. A couple of days before Christmas, we gathered by the pigsty. Mammy held a large white porcelain bowl, Papi a rope, our landlord a long butcher knife. Our next-door neighbor and her sons had set up a table on sawhorses nearby, and a cauldron of water bubbled over the fire in the pit, tended by some people I didn't recognize. Papi tied the squealing pig by its legs and, with the help of one of the men, turned it over and carried it to the table. Our landlord drew a necklace on the pig's neck with one swift arc of the knife and blood gushed into Mommy's porcelain bowl, squirted droplets onto her apron, bright red spots that gelled into maroon dots. "The tail is mine," I announced, and the grown-ups laughed. "You have to earn it," our neighbor said. She handed me a bowl into which the pig's guts spilled like syrup, quivering pink, blue, and yellow, warm and musky, alive, hard to imagine, as solid, piquant brown sausages. While the men dressed and roasted the pig, Mommy and the women made pasteles. They grated plantains, green bananas, yautías, and yuca into bowls, seasoned the mixture, spooned mounds of it onto roasted banana leaves, and dropped chunks of savory meat into the centers of the mounds. They then folded the banana leaves into rectangles, tied them with cotton twine, and dropped the pasteles into a huge pot of boiling water. They split ripe coconuts open, broke the thick white meat into chunks that we children grated when we weren't munching. The flakes were squeezed for coconut milk to be used for arroz con dulce and tembleque. Some of the coconut milk was mixed with sweet evaporated milk, sugar, egg yolks, and rum to make coquito. I helped Papi string colored lights across the yard, and we decorated an eggplant bush with crepe paper flowers and cut-out figures. For once, the music coming from the other side of our wall was festive and hopeful, with only one or two songs blaming women for men's troubles. On Christmas Eve, the bar was closed, and neighbors came out of their houses dragging tables, which were lined up along one of our yard and then laden with food made by women I'd never seen, who came in and out as if they were long-lost relatives, stroking our hair, smiling at me and my sisters and brothers as if we were the most wonderful creatures on earth. A group of men showed up with a cuatro, a guitar, maracas, and güiros. The middle of the yard was cleared and swept for a dance floor. We all sang aguinaldos, and for the rest of the night, people danced and sang and ate and drank and celebrated as if we were all friends and had only needed an excuse to get together. "Tomorrow I'm taking you to visit your cousins," Mommy said some weeks later. "What cousins?" "Gladys and Angie. They're really my cousins, but they're your age. You're spending a few days with them." They lived in a cement house with a blue and white porch next to Lalo's Cafetín, a landmark in the area known as La Parada 22. Mommy had grown up on this street, and Tio Lalo had built his fortune here in a store that specialized in homemade sweets and Puerto Rican fast food, codfish fritters, fried plantain balls, and his famous stuffed potatoes. We were greeted by his wife, Angelina, and their two daughters. On the way to their house, Mommy had told me to be especially nice to Gladys, and when I met her, I understood why. She was tall and gaunt, with huge black watery eyes and a timid manner that told me she would remain Jamona the rest of her life. Her sister, Angie, was pretty, lively, with a quick sense of humor and the air and manner of someone who was used to getting her way. I liked Gladys better, but I could see that Angie was more fun. "Girls, take Neggy and show her your rooms," Angelina said. Angie bounded off behind a curtain, and I followed Gladys, who walked at a leisurely pace as if counting seconds. "This is where we will sleep," Gladys said, stepping into a narrow room by a neatly made bed that took up most of the floor space. A small Miami window looked out on a cement yard and the wall of the next house. There was a small rug in front of the bed and a long bare dresser across from it, near a door to another room patched with pictures of singers and movie stars. "Those are her pictures," Gladys muttered in a voice that reminded me of the sound from a comb harmonica. "You can come in now," Angie sang and opened the door crack. "Not you," she said to her sister. Gladys backed away and lay on her bed, hands on her chest, her huge eyes fixed on the ceiling. Angie's room was pink and ruffled, carpeted and decorated with stuffed animals, dolls, and pictures of American movie stars. She had her own pink record player and a collection of albums. Books and magazines were stacked in a basket near her bed. The dresser held a matched comb and brush set, a mirror tray with tiny perfume bottles shaped like kittens and bunnies. On the night table, a ballerina held aloft a lamp shade, and a soft pink light bathed her porcelain tutu, accentuating the curves of her strong legs. Wow! I couldn't help myself. Even Jenny's room wasn't this nice. You can't come in unless I ask you, Angie said, and I backed away, afraid that if I touched anything, I would stain or break or somehow contaminate the feminine air of this fragrant room. Angie closed the door. I retreated to the edge of Gladys's bed and stared at the curtain leading to the room where Mommy and Angelina murmured in soft cadences. She's so mean, Gladys muttered. Mamita and Papito spoil her just because she's the youngest. It seemed strange that Gladys should call her parents by the diminutive, which was usually reserved for small children. They insist we call them that, she said, as if she had read my mind. I know it sounds babyish, but they make us do it. I looked around her room, the only decoration in it a framed copy of the Lord's Prayer. Soft music came from Angie's door so faintly that it could have been in the house next door. Don't you have a radio? I asked. No, my mother is evangelical. She doesn't like the radio, unless it's preachers. A wave roiled inside my stomach and my fingertips and toes felt cold. In Macung, many of our neighbors were evangelicals. The men dressed in neat white shirts and ties, and the women wore sleeved blouses and long skirts in solid, dull colors year-round. They never cut their hair and didn't wear makeup, shorts, or jewelry. They didn't dance, drink, or read popular novels. Every other word out of their mouth was, "Blessed be the Lord," or "Alleluia," and they went around door-to-door every Sunday selling religious magazines. From what I could see, they lived dull, inhibited lives. But they lived them with a fervor that was frightening. Our family never went to church, and I worried that people who did were infallible, and we were wrong in our willful resistance to religious guidance. Mommy had not told me Uncle Lalo and Angelina were evangelicals, and I worried that she didn't know and that they would try to convert me. Then I wouldn't be any fun and would spend the rest of my days selling the watchtower and brushing my long hair into a single braid that dangled down my back. I went to see my mother, I said to Gladys, and stepped through the curtain. Mommy and Angelina were in the kitchen cooking. Mommy, can we go now? No, silly, you're spending a few days here. She said it with an edge to her voice, letting me know I was being disrespectful by asking to leave when we hadn't even eaten. Angelina smiled. And you haven't seen your Tio Lalo's store yet. Come, and you can choose a dessert for after dinner. She led me through a door into a room with a long table and a sink on either side. There were shelves along the wall and a refrigerator. Against a corner, there was a stack of burlap sacks with fancy black lettering. Potatoes. We stepped down twice into another room dominated by glass front refrigerator cases that served as the counter for the store. On either side of the narrow center aisle, there were more refrigerated cases for ice cream and sodas, and the walls of the store were dappled with candy in shiny cellophane wrappers clipped to metal skeletons. Tio Lalo stood behind the counter. Every second we were there, he was serving people lined up to buy his stuffed potato balls or his creamy tembleque. "Hello," he murmured, his solemn face not giving any hint that he was happy to see me. "Pick any sweet you like," he said. I looked around, unable to decide until he pulled a Hershey's milk chocolate bar from the wall. "Take this one," he said, "and get back to the house." Even though I wouldn't have chosen that one, I took it and scrammed, sensing that the store, with all its colors and things to make a child happy, belonged to Tio Lalo alone, and not even his family was allowed to go in there. Angelina's cooking was bland and colorless. Before we could eat, she offered a prayer, and we had to bow our heads to hear it. At the end, Mommy elbowed me so that I would say amen along with everyone else. "So how long will you be in New York?" Tio Lalo asked. Everyone looked at me. Mommy wore a frightened expression. "A couple of weeks," she said. "You're going to New York?" I couldn't believe she hadn't told me. Now I knew why I had to spend time in this quiet, cheerless house. "Your grandmother made an appointment for Raymond to see a specialist. Maybe they can save his foot." It was an apology, not a reason. "But why didn't you tell me?" I couldn't help the whine in my voice, the tightness that closed my throat, making it difficult to speak without pain. "Why can't I go with you?" "Your mommy can't afford to take both of you," Angelina said. "It's very expensive to go to New York. Besides, we're so happy to have you. You've never been to visit us," she said, as if it were my fault. "Come on," Tio Lalo muttered. "Don't make it hard for your mommy." Mommy had never needed anyone to defend her, and all of a sudden it was as if she were the child and I the grown-up who was exacting justification for something that should have been obvious. "I'll come for you as soon as I get back," she said. "When?" "A couple of weeks." "But when? Which day?" I didn't care if they all thought I was a spoiled, disrespectful, impertinent brat. Mommy took in a long, deep breath that doubled the size of her chest and cleared the blush from her cheeks. "Sunday after next." She was embarrassed by my behavior, but she wasn't going to do anything about it in front of her uncle. "What time?" I pushed. 1:30 in the afternoon," she said through her teeth. "Your beans are getting cold," Angelina murmured, her voice a meow. I ate the tasteless beans, the sticky rice, the greasy fried chicken. To my right, Mommy felt tense and tight, but she talked to Angelina and Tio Lalo as if nothing special was happening, as if disappearing into the sky for weeks was something she did all the time, like killing chickens and washing her hair. Across from me, Angie toyed with her food, dispersing it over her plate so that it would look as if she'd eaten it. Gladys munched us slowly and deliberately as a cow, her huge black eyes fixed on me, her lips curled into a slight smile. That night, I lay next to Gladys, unable to sleep. "If I ever talk to Mamita like that," Gladys whispered, "Papito would beat me until I had no skin left." I felt no sympathy, no desire to accept hers. Once I talked back, and Papito took me behind the kitchen and beat me with his belt. I had no idea where my sisters and brothers were, who was watching them while Mommy took Raymond to New York. I wondered if Papi had to stay home from work. Why couldn't I stay with him and the kids? After all, I was the oldest. Angie talked back all the time, but they never hit her. Mommy probably didn't trust me with my sisters and brothers. After Raymond's accident, she never left me alone with them for more than an hour. Maybe she knew his accident was my fault. Papito favors her because she's named after Mamita. I don't know why they didn't give me her name. I'm the oldest. I should have my mother's name. Mommy was probably planning to stay in New York and leave us in Puerto Rico. Maybe she had given us away, the way people who couldn't take care of their kids did. Maybe she gave me away to Tio Lalo and Angelina because they were so strict. "They make me peel all the potatoes. She always has an excuse. Now they'll probably make you peel her potatoes while she sleeps late." "What potatoes? What are you talking about?" "For the stuffed potato balls. Papito is famous around here for them." "What does that have to do with me?" "You're here to peel potatoes. Every morning he boils 2 sackfuls, and we can't do anything else until they're clean or Papito gets mad." "Why do we have to do it?" "Who else? He has to tend the store, and Mamita has to clean the house." It wasn't fair. Mommy had given me away to evangelicals who would make me peel potatoes all day long. I scrunched the pillow over my head and let the sobs out. It seemed like more punishment than I deserved for letting Raymond have an accident. Tio Lalo set the potatoes to cook as soon as he woke up, and he had drained them by the time Gladys and I sat down to breakfast. No sooner did we finish eating than he called us into the room behind the store. "Show her how it's done," he said to Gladys. She speared a steaming potato with a fork and showed me how to peel it until there wasn't a spot on it. "If there are any peels left," she said, "the balls come out gritty and the customers complain." "The potatoes had to be peeled while they were hot," she explained, "because the skin stuck if they got too cold. Papito," she said, "didn't want a lot of waste." Every so often, Tio Lalo came and stood behind me to see how I was doing. Whenever he did, I shook inside, but let my fingers fly over the potatoes, stripping off every centimeter of skin until they were clean, yellow, and unblemished. 2 Sundays later, I woke up early, peeled potatoes, then packed my bag. I showered, braided my hair with ribbons, and sat in the living room reading a religious magazine while I waited for Mommy to pick me up. Angelina had taken the girls to church, as she did every Sunday. To my relief, Angelina didn't seem intent on converting me. She had probably given me up for lost to the devil the first day we met. I sat in my nice dress, with my good shoes on, trying to look as innocent and good as I possibly could so that when Mommy came, she would see that I had learned my lesson. But Mommy didn't come. Angelina and the girls came back from church, and we sat down to Sunday supper, and Angie disappeared into her room and Gladys into hers, and I waited, feeling more and more abandoned as afternoon lengthened into evening then night. Tio Lalo closed the store, came inside the house, found me sitting on the same chair, my bag at my side, the religious magazine crinkled from having been read so many times. "She's not coming." "How do you know?" "She wrote me a letter that says she's coming next Friday." He smiled. He was lying, even though he was evangelical and they were supposed to tell the truth. He had waited until I was humiliated before bothering to tell me she wouldn't be coming that day. But his lie about the letter was only covering up for what we both knew. Mommy wasn't coming today, and no one knew when she would return. I picked up my bag and sidled past him, my eyes flooded with the tears that were lately so close to the surface. I heard him chuckle as I went into Gladys's room and undressed, crumpling my dress and pretty ribbons into a ball as solid and round as his stuffed potatoes. She came with presents wrapped in the Daily News. For me, a yellow handbag with a small mirror on the flap. "And at home, I have a lot of clothes sent by your New York cousins." She was excited and handed Angelina, Tio Lalo, Angie, and Gladys their presents while she chattered about Tata and Anna and Margot and Guri and Chico and all our relatives in New York. The doctors who had seen Raymond were the best in the world, she told us, and had assured her that with the proper treatment, his foot would heal as good as new. I hung on to her, afraid that when it was time to leave, she would forget me. But she didn't. She helped me pack my bag, put a couple of pennies in my yellow handbag, and we walked away from Tio Lalo's laden with sweets for my sisters and brothers and a dozen freshly fried stuffed potato balls. On the bus, Mommy told me how tall the buildings were in New York and how she had traveled around on trains that were much faster and nicer than our crowded, stuffy buses. We got off at a different stop, and when I told her we'd made a mistake, she said, "No, it's all right. We've moved." Casi Señorita, con la música por dentro, with the music inside. I didn't mean to steal the nickels from the baby's glass piggy bank, but they left me alone with her, and the pig sat right there on top of the dresser as she slept. I had no idea an old lady was peeking in the window and saw me tip the pig over and slide out one nickel, two, three at most. When Papi gave me a talk about being trustworthy and Mommy a few cocotazos, I wasn't sorry I stole the money. I was mad that no one asked why the neighbor had been looking in the window. That snoopy old lady in our new neighborhood put an end to my babysitting career, and the well-intentioned neighbor next door ensured that I would never go to church. "Even if you don't accept the Lord," she told my mother one day as they chatted on opposite sides of their fences, "you can send your children to Sunday school. At least it gives you a free morning." Mommy lined us up for a bath, and in keeping with the occasion, checked behind our ears and around our necks so that, even though people might complain we were heathens, no one could say we weren't clean. Hector and Raymond were buttoned into their school assembly shirts, and us girls put on our good dresses, while Mammy combed our hair into tight braids held at the nape with modest white ribbons. "No picking your nose, no sucking your thumb, no speaking unless spoken to." She pulled up Delsa's socks and buckled Alicia's shoes. "No pushing or shoving each other. Say, with your permission and muchas gracias, and you're very welcome." She pulled up Hector's pants and tucked in his shirt. "If you need to use the bathroom, aim so you don't make a mess, and wash your hands afterwards." She didn't really need to go through all the rules on behavior. They were engraved on our brains from constant repetition and the painful results of not following them to the letter. But Mommy was not one to take chances with our natural high spirits and tendency to ignore what she told us the minute she turned her back. "Doña Susana will be there watching you," Mommy warned, unnecessarily, since we expected another pair of eyes as stern and unforgiving as hers to watch our every move when she wasn't around. "Now go along to church." The Iglesia San Juan Bautista de Paz y Misericordia was up the street from our house. It had once been a private home, but its owner went off to train as a minister, and when he came back, he held services in his living room. Before long, the congregation had grown so large that he moved elsewhere and refurnished the house with rows of wooden pews and a tiled fountain in the place once occupied by the family's television set. "Ay, qué lindos!" Doña Susana exclaimed when we paraded into the churchyard. She tugged on the sleeve of a thin young woman. "Sister Dolores, these are the children I was telling you about." Sister Dolores led us to the rear of the house, where she segregated us by age into small groups led by bespectacled young men and well-scrubbed young women. "You," she said to me, "are old enough to sit with the congregation." I joined the older children in the back of the church just as the service began. In contrast to Abuela's opulent church, this iglesia was plain, with nothing to divert attention from the service. The white house walls were unadorned. The fountain looked like a tile bathtub. The preacher, Don Joaquin, was slight, with child-sized hands, delicate shoulders, and a thin neck trapped inside the collar of a starched shirt. "Sisters and brothers," he began in a voice so deep I looked around to see where it came from, but Don Joaquin stood alone in front of his congregation. In less time than it took me to say the Lord's Prayer, he had worked himself into a frenzy that sent the congregation to its feet, moaning their repentance and the ecstasy of redemption. Don Joaquin called on sinners to cast off evil and come to Jesus. Men and women who until that day had been sedate citizens, a solemn storekeeper, the unsmiling man who delivered the mail, the stern school crossing guard, the methodical newspaper vendor, stood up in rapture, ran to the front of the room, knelt in front of Don Joaquin, grabbed for his hands, waved their arms about in jerky motions. Tears streamed down their cheeks, their voices charged with sobs, choked laughter, unfinished prayers, joyous gratitude. These proper folk, who had always maintained an appearance of peaceful reserve, now rolled in the aisles with abandon. Don Joaquin's voice rose in timbre and pitch until he seemed to disappear, and only his words remained, reverberating against the cement walls, piercing the assembled into delirious convulsions and ecstatic trances. Every hair on my body stood on end as I witnessed these transformations. A bristling sweat seeped into my clothes, dribbled behind my ears. I wanted to wail, to wave my arms in exuberance, to give myself up right then and there to the unexplainable force that overpowered the others in the room. But my fear was too great, my conscience too precocious to allow me to relinquish control of my well-guarded soul. I was alone, isolated in a bubble of resistance, watching this surreal scene magnified beyond comprehension. I crumpled onto the hard pew and hid my face behind my hands, through which bright specks of light still danced in circles. "If she wants to play the piano, let her," Papi argued, pride in his voice. "How can we afford a piano?" Mommy asked. "We don't even have a television set." "She doesn't need a piano while she's studying. Don Luis said she can come over and practice there any time." Mommy turned up her nose. "That buttery old man. He's the principal of the school, Monin. Everyone else holds him in high regard. He has shifty eyes and he can't sit still. He's a musician. Those people always seem nervous to the rest of us." I had not meant to start a contest of wills between my parents when I mentioned my dreams of playing the piano to Papi. My hands seemed to yearn for action, moving constantly as I talked, seeking textures when I sat reading a book, digging fearlessly into holes on walls, dipping into containers, drawers, boxes with lids that didn't quite close. Since I loved music, learning to play piano seemed like a good choice, even though I'd never actually seen a piano, let alone had any idea of what it took to play one. When I mentioned it to Papi, he was excited. The idea of a concert career for me appealed to his vision of himself as a poet, and of me as more than a spunky tomboy. He took it upon himself to find me a teacher, and came up with the principal at my new school. An elderly gentleman with thinning hair and a thick mustache that seemed pasted on his delicate features. "We wouldn't have to pay anything," Papi said, "because he's willing to give you lessons in exchange for some carpentry on his porch." On Sunday afternoon, I set off with Papi for my first piano lesson. I had never seen a teacher outside of school, and as we neared Don Luis's house, I was scared and dug my thumbnail into the other nails to scrape out any dirt that might have escaped the scratchy bristles of Mommy's vegetable brush. "Buenas," he greeted us. I held on to Papi's hand as to a lifeline, not trusting my knocking knees to hold me up. But Don Luis's warm smile soon melted my fear into awe at finding myself in his house, away from the unpleasant implications of a student face-to-face with the school principal. His house was detached from those around it, surrounded by flowers that bloomed in splendid colors and overwhelming fragrances. The inside was small, but as ornate as the yard, with lace curtains, glass-topped tables, invitingly curvy furniture, and dominating the back wall, an enormous reddish-brown piano, lustrous and dust-free, majestic against a fabric-covered wall. I looked at Papi, who winked at me and smiled. We shared the joy of being in this room, in the home of an artist, a person whose life was gracious and carefree, whose furnishings and decorations were as impractical as ours were utilitarian. "Well," Papi said, "I'll get to work outside." He left me in the room, which suddenly became as foreign as another country. Don Luis led me to the piano and showed me how to open it to reveal the gleaming white and black keys that welcomed me to a world as removed from my everyday life as I could ever hope to get. He ran his fingers across with a light touch, and I noticed how long and tapered they were, how feminine. "You place your hands on the keys like this." He led me through the lesson. In the background, Papi sawed and hammered in a rhythm much more musical than what I conjured from the piano. But when the hour was over, Don Luis insisted that I showed aptitude and suggested that in the future I should come at a different time because Papi's hammering interfered with my timing. After that, Mommy walked me to Don Luis's house, then let me come home by myself. She didn't insist that I dress up as long as my clothes were neat and clean, but Don Luis cared what I wore. He often commented on the color of a blouse or the cut of a skirt, and once he suggested that next time I wear the same sleeveless scoop-neck dress. Its blue flowers, he said, were pretty. When I told Mommy, she made a face, and that night she muttered to Papi about what that dirty old man is up to. You know she's casi señorita. Until then, Mommy had used the excuse that I was almost pubescent to warn me against playing with boys, to insist that I do something useful like housework or cooking, and to remind me to sit with my legs together. But now she was using the familiar phrase as a warning to Papi, not to me, as if it were he who had to do something about my semi-status. It excited me that being casi señorita meant my piano teacher saw me as more than a gifted student. The next time I went for my lesson, I wore the sleeveless scoop-neck dress, which until then had been a favorite only because it kept me cool, and its broad skirt made it possible to sit cross-legged without my panties showing. "So pretty," Don Luis said as I came in. "So nice." We began the lesson with my tortured scales, but he interrupted to put his arm around me, to demonstrate, he said, the proper position of my wrist. He was as fragrant as the flowers outside his window, as slight, but he trembled with a warmth I'd never felt before, an almost imperceptible tremor that somehow transferred to me. I nudged him, respectfully, as if by accident. He returned his arm to his own body and slid over. he said, and straightened his collar. I continued playing, but was unable to concentrate because I kept the corner of my eye on his restless hands, the elegant fingertips that danced against the pale blue fabric of his pants. "No, no, no!" He took my fingers into his left hand and, with the right, slapped me hard. I hopped off the bench, humiliated. "Why'd you do that? You're striking the keys like they're conga drums. This is a very delicate instrument. The touch has to be light. Light!" He wiggled his fingers in the air. "Now sit down and try again." I sat as far away from him as possible without falling off the bench, elbows butterflied to give me even more room. He stood up, walked behind me, bent over, and gently pushed my arms close to my ribcage, held them there. "Better," he said softly. He hovered above me, his fingers on my elbows as light as flour, his skin shivering against mine. I pounded my unease into the keys, hoping the discordance would drive him away, but he held on. His breath fanned my hair as he bent closer. I hunched away from him and saw how the neckline on my dress puffed out for a clear view to anyone standing above of the slight mounds like egg yolks that had recently begun to ache on my chest. I jumped up and pulled the neckline of the dress up until my fists were against my chin. He stepped back, hands in front of him in a position similar to the one I used to keep Mommy from striking me. His eyes were wide, his skin mottled pink and white, his mouth invisible behind his mustache. "Viejo asqueroso!" I screamed, in a voice and tone borrowed from my mother. "Filthy old man!" Shame rose from the ground and wrapped me in a hot, turbulent funnel that I wished would lift me out of this room, away from my school principal's startled blue eyes and quivering, elegant fingers. I shuddered with fear and rage. I felt soiled, as if his gaze had branded my naked chest. He spoke, but I couldn't make sense of what he said, nor did I stay to listen. I backed out of his house, confused, arms wrapped around myself, head heavy, as if it had grown until I felt I had no body. That night, when I told them what happened, Mommy and Papi had a loud fight. I was not to study piano anymore, and Papi was to have a talk with Don Luis. As if she didn't trust Papi to do it right, Mommy went to school the next day to have her own discussion with the school principal. And for the rest of the year, whenever we passed in the hall, Don Luis sought the distance directly above and beyond me, as if I had become invisible as dust. If I stepped out of our new house on Calle Castroviña, up the block and to the left, I could walk through a quiet, shadowy street that curved in and out of unpaved alleys and, within minutes, be sitting at my grandmother's table, eating guanimes, which were cornmeal patties stuffed with cheese, wrapped in a banana leaf, and then boiled. Mommy didn't make guanimes. Too much work, she said. Abuela didn't think they were too much work. Every Friday, she made them and served them with a clear fish head broth on the surface of which floated fresh cilantro. My grandfather had died the year before, of old age. When I came to Abuela's house, I mourned the emptiness of his room, from which he had emerged dressed in his white long-sleeved shirt and pants, his feet bare, his platinum hair cropped to a stubble. Once, while Abuela was in the kitchen, I stepped inside Abuelo's room. Everything looked the same, the narrow cot, the colorful picture of Jesus's bleeding head crowned with thorns, a palm frond nailed above it, the simple table and chair. The room was cold, its cement walls whiter than I remembered, the window shaded by a breadfruit tree, its large leaves shedding pale reflections against the ceiling. I touched the small pillow where Abuelo's head had rested and had an image of him deftly peeling an orange in a long ribbon to his bare feet, which were brown, calloused, and delicately shaped. "He's in heaven with Papa Dios," Abuela said behind me, startling me out of the brooding sorrow that pressed against my chest. I let her lead me to the table where the hot broth and gritty cornmeal soothed the ache. "I hope when your mommy is in New York you will come visit me," she said as we washed dishes. "Mommy already went to New York, last spring." "I think she's going again. Generosa will stay with you for a few weeks." I dried my hands on the hem of my dress and leaned against the sink. I took the emptiness of Abuelo's room inside myself, the cold, stippled walls, desolate and hard. "You know your little brother's foot is still giving him problems." I knew that, but it didn't matter. His pain meant he got to spend more time with Mommy than any of us did. He got to travel to New York, a place Mommy spoke of with reverence. "You have to be a help to your Mommy," Abuela said. "You're the oldest. She depends on you." I caved into my misery. Mommy was leaving, and once more she hadn't told me, hadn't included me in her plans. "I don't like it when she goes away," I cried into Abuela's shoulder, the only place where I could express my loneliness, my fears. To have told Mommy would have been wrong. She was overwhelmed by what she called the sacrifices I have to endure for you kids, and my love, expressed in demands, added a greater burden. I was keenly aware that she wasn't my mother. I had to share her with Delsa, Norma, Hector, Alicia, Edna, and Raymond. But it seemed that somehow my share was smaller, because I was the oldest, because I was casi señorita, because I ought to know better. I walked home from Abuela's house, feeling Mammy's absence, as if she had already left. By the time I got home, I had wrapped myself in the blanket of responsibility she was about to drop on me. It felt heavy, too big for me. Yet, if I made the wrong move, I was afraid it would tear, exposing the slight, frightened child inside. It wasn't that when Mommy was gone we misbehaved more. It was simply that I couldn't muster her authority, couldn't manage to keep my sisters and brother in line with her strict rules of behavior. Not when I, too, saw an opportunity to break them. "What do you kids like to eat?" Titi Generosa asked us, her voice scratching as a guiro. "Oatmeal," Hector sang. "Oatmeal," Delsa and Norma agreed. "What else?" Titi Generosa asked. "Pork chops and fried potatoes," I said. "I don't like fried potatoes," Edna pouted. "And I don't like the pork chops if they're too crisp," Alicia said, her blank-toothed grin an explanation. "But you all like oatmeal." "Yay!" we shrieked, as if she had just answered the question that won the jackpot. "All right," she mumbled. "Oatmeal it will be." I liked Titi Generosa. Her voice, which everyone said sounded as if she were hoarse, came forth in the rhythmic Jíbaro dialect I loved. But there was one thing Mami had warned us about, a habit we were not to pick up from her under any circumstances. Titi Generosa had a foul mouth. She lived next to her mother, my abuela, whose every other word had God in it, was sister to my father, who wrote poems, and to Tio Vidal, who recited poetry as he clipped men's hair in his barbershop. But Titi Generosa wasn't inclined toward elegant speech, nor toward euphemisms. She spoke her mind in the most crude language I'd ever heard, as if there were nothing shameful in it, as if calling a woman a puta were not embarrassing. I loved that about her, and wished for the courage to